Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. It is June 1st, 2005. I'm your host, Stephen Novella, president of the New England Skeptical Society. With me today are Perry DeAngelis.
Good evening, all.
Robert Novella.
Hello, everyone.
And Evan Bernstein.
A pleasure to be with you.
Welcome, everyone. So first, let's do some follow-up on the Kansas school board situation. Kansas, not for the first time, has been having hearings about specifically whether or not to let intelligent design into science classrooms in Kansas. You've all been following this?
Oh, yes. Mm-hmm.
Absolutely.
Oh,
one of the interesting aspects of this face-off is that scientists decided to boycott the meetings, figuring that the hearings were rigged against science to begin with. The board members who were predisposed to intelligent design weren't going to have their minds changed in any case. And they essentially did not want to validate the hearings by giving testimony. An interesting strategy. We have to see how that is going to work out. But another interesting aspect of this is the fact that the Kansas School Board actually wants to change the definition of science itself.
Pretty bold.
Extremely bold.
This
has been what, you know, scientists have warned about for decades, why, you know, teaching creationism in science classrooms is a bad thing, because it actually degrades the entire scientific enterprise. It goes well beyond just the issue of evolution. And here they are. This is exactly what they're saying. So the definition that they want is the following. They want to define science as a systematic method of continuing investigation.
Okay.
Which may sound reasonable at first blush, but what they're changing it from is a systematic method of finding natural explanations for the world around us. Mm-hmm. They essentially, the point of the intelligent design people, again for those who may not know, intelligent design is the idea that the world is so complicated that it had to have been created by an intelligent designer. Who that intelligent or what that intelligent designer is, they do not state. But it's basically warmed over creationism. You know, as one scientist characterized it, creationism in a cheap tuxedo. But they basically took the core beliefs and claims of creationism, the idea that God created the world and it is not the product of natural processes like evolution, and removed from it anything overtly religious, like the word God. But it's essentially the same set of beliefs. It's just really evolution denial.
Right.
In any case, one of the, especially the lawyer Philip Johnson, who is an ID proponent, and his basic position is that the definition of science only allows for naturalistic or natural explanations, and that this essentially rigs the game against religion or against supernatural explanations in an unfair way. And that line of argument has obviously been persuasive in Kansas, and the school board wants to, in fact, change the definition of science. Have you all heard this before?
Yes.
Oh, yes, absolutely.
Yeah. It's an outrage.
And I've had this discussion with ID proponents as well, that is core to their agenda. Again, not just, you know, allowing for, you know, creationism in the guise of intelligent design to be taught as science and to erode and water down and limit the teaching of evolution as much as possible.
But it's not just evolution, which is bad enough. Of course, I mean, there's other parts of science that they have explicitly attacked in the past, like the Kansas Board of Education in 1998. They also wanted to eliminate statements about the Big Bang.
Right, the Big
Bang. And also facts about, you know, the Earth being older than 10,000 years. And the theory of plate tectonics, well, it doesn't stop at evolution. It stops
no, it definitely
anything,
does not.
Anything
right.
that makes that threatens their worldview, and that's a lot of science that's going to do that. So that's just
sure.
like
yeah, it, basically all the historical sciences would fall under their sword. But even beyond just the historical sciences, and the one that you mentioned again is just the very definition of science. And I think the key misunderstanding
right.
here. Is that it's not that scientists arbitrarily exclude non-natural explanations as possible scientific explanations. It's that science by definition cannot deal with supernatural or magical or miraculous explanations. It's incompatible with the methods of science. Science can only deal with things that can be falsified, that can be proven false. And you can't prove a miracle false, because a miracle can't be constrained by natural laws or by anything that could prove it false.
Exactly. It's outside the realm of testing.
Right. It's outside the realm of testing and therefore science. It's a matter of definition. To allow for supernatural explanations would completely undermine the entire enterprise of science.
But Steve, how realistic is it that these people can actually redefine science? I mean, how is that really going to have an impact on scientists and the way they do work? I mean, it could obviously affect education and how our kids are learn science, but I mean, what kind of real impact could this have? I mean,
well,
it's like redefining gravity. I mean, it's still going to be there.
Yeah.
But you think it's true. I mean, the institution of science isn't going anywhere, but you have to remember that science is a cultural and a societal institution. It survives on the goodwill of the citizens of this society, and it will its success and its power will depend greatly on the public support for it. If you raise a generation of kids who have a complete misconception about what science is and how it works, these are the people who are going to be voters when they get older. They're going to be lawmakers. They're going to be in Congress, and there are some very concrete ways in which this kind of distortion of science can have an effect. For example, who decides where the billions of dollars of federal funding for scientific research goes? Should that money go to fund research into miraculous explanations for things? Well, if you think that miracles are a proper subject for scientific investigation, then sure, you'll vote yes to divert millions or billions of federal funding to those things. So that's just one example of a very concrete way in which this kind of distortion of science could literally erode the support of science. Right? I mean, science survives. It's fine to say that the abstract concept of science is not going to change because scientists still know what it is, but you have a bunch of scientists sitting around knowing what science is doesn't mean anything if they don't have any money to do research.
Mm-hmm.
And that money is coming from typically politicians who have a public school education in science.
I think it would be devastating to the students of Kansas on so many different levels, and not the least of which is if I were a college admissions officer, I would look very differently on an applicant from Kansas.
Absolutely.
Than I would from other states, to say the very least.
Yeah, that's true, and that's one way that outside pressure gets put onto these school boards. But
I mean, wasn't Kansas was ridiculed when this came out? I mean, there was like worldwide ridicule. People all over the world shaking their head, like, "You've got to be kidding me!" And I think that played into the scenario of how things turned around there, albeit temporarily. When they had the following vote, and they voted out a lot of these fundamentalists from the board and stuff. I think that played a hand. The condemnation that they suffered, but unfortunately, it wasn't very long lived.
Right. I mean, these grassroots fights at the state level are not going to go away anytime soon, and the creationists are just getting more and more slick at pursuing their agenda. I mean, think about it. Originally they were trying to ban evolution from the schools,
mm-hmm.
and
that
obviously that destroyed a generation of evolution teaching in this country. But obviously that's not going to get through the courts now. So then they said, okay, we won't ban evolution. Let's just go for equal time.
Right.
We just want creationism to have equal time in the name of academic fairness.
Right.
And then that got them another round.
In science class.
In science class. That got them, you know, they got 5-10 years out of that ploy until the Supreme Court struck it down numerous times. And now we're seeing the next
repackaged
phase.
Creationism.
Yeah, the next phase of their agenda.
Creationism 2.0.
Changing the definition of science to a systematic method of continuing investigation. You know, how many people are going to recognize what the implication of that is at first sight?
It's subtle.
They're getting very subtle. They're getting very intelligent design, you know, removing all mention of God or anything overtly religious, but maintaining the core, you know, claims of evolution denial. They're getting very slick and
very insidious.
Very insidious.
That's the intelligent design here.
Yeah, the evolution of creationism.
Yeah, I love that.
You know, and they're also very much interested in surrounding themselves with the trappings of legitimacy and of science, because then
everybody wants that.
It becomes harder for the public to tell the difference between real science and fake science. For example, you know, you all may have heard that the Discovery Institute is essentially an organization dedicated to promoting intelligent design. They're supposed to be dedicated to doing research, but I don't think they do any actual research. They basically are just a propaganda organization.
Right.
That they are going to be previewing a film at the Smithsonian Institution.
Of all places.
Have you heard about this?
June 23rd, they're going to do it.
June 23rd, yes, if all goes as planned. They will be airing it. Now, the film is called The Privileged Planet, The Search for Purpose in the Universe. Again, kind of a soft sell title. You know,
sounds subtle enough.
What does that really mean? But again, it gets to that interjection of explanations, you know, that are outside the realm of science. Purpose in the universe?
Right.
I mean, that is not the purview of science. That is
exactly. And even the authors seem to me tailor-made for this kind of endeavor. You've got Guillermo Gonzalez. He's an ISU assistant professor of astronomy and physics, and they must love when they get a scientist to help them in their cause.
And
then the other co-author is a gentleman named J.W. Richards, and he's the vice president and senior fellow of the Discovery Institute. I mean, what a perfect blend to produce something like this. I would expect, you know, nothing less than to have a scientist and a senior fellow of the Discovery Institute. Perfect combination to put this together. And I'm really disappointed in the Smithsonian for allowing something like this to happen. It's really surprising. They kind of soft sell it. They're saying that anybody can hold an event at the Smithsonian, but it can't be a personal event, fundraising, or a religious or partisan political event.
Now, how do they define this one?
Right. I mean, this, you know, it's not overtly religious, but there's definitely a religious subtext in this entire thing.
It's backdoor religion.
Well, yeah. I mean, they say intelligent design. It doesn't have to be God. It doesn't have to be the Judeo-Christian God, but I mean, let's face it, the whole thing is based on that. And to be opposed to ID, I think in many people's minds, really to be opposed to creationism, is in some way in opposition to God. I think a lot of people think that way. I think it's very emotional for people. It's very hard for them to care enough or to want to throw their hat into that ring. They'd rather just be quiet.
Well,
on the sidelines.
And also, evolution is not the easiest of subjects to just, you know, put your mind around and grasp. It's a much easier concept to think, okay, creationism, you know, you don't have to think that hard about it and sort of accept it and go on your way. Whereas evolution, you really, you know, you have to kind of know what's going on.
It takes a lot of study to really understand it. It's a very beautiful and elegant and subtle theory.
It really is, but it's not quantum mechanics. I mean, it's
right.
I mean, you can get a good overview of biology, of evolution and biology, and anybody can grasp it if they just put a little bit of effort into it. You know, if they have any interest and just do a little bit of reading,
If they're educated, if it's included in their science program.
Well, right. And this is really the crux of the matter.
In a country where all polls indicate where 90% of us have faith, are religious in some way. It's not an easy sell.
Yeah, but
less than 50% believe in evolution.
Right.
Less than 50%.
Which is disgusting. But I mean, look at all the major religions that support evolution. Catholicism. The Pope totally supports evolution. I mean, because it is undeniable.
It does not have to be anti-religion.
It does not.
Can and should be separate.
There's plenty of scientists that believe in it. It's not a mutually exclusive thing, but they want to portray it as such.
Now, getting back to the Smithsonian Institute thing, and you mentioned maybe that he's just trying to be politically correct or what have you, but I think that he's just being naive. I agree that
here's a quote. I got a quote for you, Steve. The museum spokesman, Randall Kramer, he said, "It's incorrect for anyone to infer that we are somehow endorsing the video or content of the video." That's nice. But that's very naive. I mean, it's very naive. I've heard that.
That's why the Discovery Institute is sponsoring this film. Why they coughed up $16,000 to the Smithsonian Institute? They're doing it so that they can then say that they showed their film in the Smithsonian Institute, and to the public at large, that is a tacit endorsement.
Absolutely.
And Randall Kramer, the public affairs guy at Smithsonian Institute, is being naive. Now,
he's a believer.
That would be more astounding. I think it's
possibly.
I usually assume incompetence first rather than malevolence, but
greed. How about that?
Well,
$16,000's not.
It's easy to look the other way when someone's giving you $16,000.
Sure. Well, I hope it is greed, because if it is greed, then when they find out that the amazing Randy is offering them $20,000 not to show the video, hopefully they'll take that out of greed, and then I'll be a little happy.
It is true that JREF has countered with that offer.
He has.
And Randy's trying to expose that very point to see if it is a matter of greed or not.
Yeah, but that's a one-time fix. I would rather have
right.
them enforce their own policies. Their own policy is that they do not show films of a religious nature. This is a film of religious nature. It's insidious, it's subtle, but it's absolutely religious. I also sent Mr. Kramer an email suggesting that they broaden their policy to include egregious pseudoscience. No matter what you think about whether or not intelligent design is religion or not, it is certainly not science.
Have you gotten a reply to that email, Steve?
No, no response.
No,
he
won't reply.
Auto reply or nothing, is what I expect.
Would the Smithsonian play a video supporting the Flat Earth Society? I mean, I don't think so. I mean, even if they gave them, $16,000...
Or astrology.
For this video, I think, it's so blatantly obvious to many people that is pseudoscience. There's really nothing to it. But, this is another, this points to the insidiousness again of intelligent design, where on the surface, it doesn't quite seem as blatantly ridiculous. But once you delve into it, you realize that it's just as crazy as horoscopes and the Flat Earth Society. I mean, all of biology, relies on evolution. Biology makes no sense without evolution. It's not just a theory in quotes, which I hate that example
of.
People say, well, it's just a theory. No one's proven it 100%. Well, you can't prove it 100%. And gravity is a theory as well. So that's a tact that they take. That's really annoying.
Not just gravity. Kramer should know all this. He should be able to see through all this, and he should know
theory
all
card
this.
Is right.
That's the problem. Annoying. Right there. And, I'd like to say, if anyone goes to our website, thenes.com, thenes.com, there's a link there to the JREF if you're interested in what Randy's doing. And you can also see a copy of Steve's letter that we sent to Mr. Kramer on the website.
Now, of course, all of this brings up the broader issue of, as Bob brought up, the support for science, for science education, for scientific research in America, in the broader society and culture. And this is something which is a serious issue. For example, after Sputnik, as the conventional wisdom goes, the United States, frightened by Basically, the space race with the Soviet Union started pumping a tremendous amount of effort and more importantly, money into science and math education in this country. That led to a dramatic increase in the number of scientists that were coming out of this country into the amount of scientific research. And in fact, some people credit that ultimately with leading to the tech bubble of the 90s and the internet and all the things that we take for granted now, basically coming out of that era of extreme support for science education and scientific research.
All thanks to Sputnik.
All thanks to our red paranoia.
That's
right. Does that mean we're about to enter a generation lull of scientists?
Well, that's the thing. If we are currently experiencing a lull in the support for science, we won't feel it for 10 or 20 or 30 years. Meanwhile, our competitors like China are tremendously increasing their support for science. It may be in 20 or 30 years, you know, they're the economic leaders of the technological leaders of the world, and we're not.
God, imagine that.
That's not something you could fix overnight. You know, again, we're talking about things that take a generation to fix.
Right.
Yeah, I mean, it is generally believed that China is in the ascendancy as far as, the balance of world power goes. And this is certainly one of the ways that the leaders of China are trying to, like they are in so many different ways, compel their country into the 21st century and beyond. And it seems a highly intelligent way of going about it, frankly.
It does. Now here's some percentages. As a percentage of gross domestic product, federal investment in physical science research is half what it was in 1970. By contrast, in China, R&D expenditures rose 350% between 1991 and 2001, and the number of science and engineering PhDs soared 535%.
Well, that could be misleading, though. I mean, what's the absolute comparison?
Might
have started from an extremely low position, and we still could have more significant expenditures.
Yeah, right now, it's really the trend that we're looking at, is that we're half what we were in 1970, and they're triple what they were in 1991.
Is that in real U.S. dollars, adjusted?
No, that's not in dollars. That's by gross domestic product. That's as a percentage of.
Okay.
Again, it's indicative of the trend.
Right.
That's a problem because their population is so much vaster than our own. 1,100,000 people, I believe, was the
billion
last.
And a half. I think they're up to.
Yeah.
Is really a billion and a half. Okay, and we come in at around 350.
Right.
350 million by comparison. That's the problem.
They are a vast, untapped reservoir. I mean, and right now we're seeing that in terms of manufacturing, right? I mean, this is what a lot of economists are concerned. This gets a little bit into the free trade issue, which is beyond the scope of our discussion. But certainly, as they're a huge manufacturing base. Imagine if they become a huge base of scientific research and advancement. Why wouldn't we expect the same kind of competition?
It's true, and in a it's perhaps not PC to talk about, but you have to consider that they still live in a communist regime, and the state-enforced religion is no religion. And, that's going to have a tremendous impact on their science, on their science education and the course they take, just like our religiosity here in the U.S. is having a tremendous impact on what's happening here.
So what are you saying? That you're not going to see much of intelligent design in China?
Right.
I believe that would be illegal to teach intelligent design.
Right.
One of the granted few perks of a communist regime. There aren't many.
Well, of course, no one is suggesting that we outlaw religion.
Of course not.
We just need to keep science free from religion. And religion, the practice of religion should be free from anything outside of it trying to interfere.
Well, like Gould said, they're non-overlapping magisteria, separate domains that should not cross. They're completely separate. There is
like
no common ground.
Like the judge said on The Simpsons,
religion shall stay 500 feet from science.
If only it were so easy.
That's true.
500 feet, how about 5 miles?
Yeah, that's just not going to happen, though. It's unfortunate. It's a constant battle. We just have to be diligent. We have to educate. We have to make people aware.
Well, one specific issue that is certainly where scientific research is butting up directly against, you know, closely held religious values and beliefs is stem cell research. And this is an issue that is certainly not going to go away, at least not for the next few years, while Mr. Bush is in the White House.
Yeah, it's a very contentious issue because it calls in that granddaddy of all contentious issues, which is abortion.
When life begins.
When does life begin?
That issue has its tentacles in so much of what happens politically in this country. It's almost unfathomable. It's what the argument over judges was all about recently.
Ultimately,
it's why the Senate almost passed that filibuster banning the filibuster or being able to do it with a simple majority.
Right.
All of it ultimately comes down to abortion. So does this.
Now,
so does this.
Of course, I firmly believe that science, good science, should inform these debates, but they can't make the decision for us because ultimately it comes down to judgment calls and value judgments. There's no objective scientific answer to when does life begin. You have to make a decision, and that's why there'll never be an objective resolution to this issue. But there are some science and pseudoscientific arguments that do get brought to bear in this issue, and one caught my attention in particular. There is a Florida representative, Weldon, who, when the House recently, of course, you know, passed a bill expanding stem cell research, which Bush has promised to veto. Has that veto happened yet by June 1st?
I don't think
it's happened as of yet.
And that would be his first veto, wouldn't it?
It would be. If he does veto, it would be his first veto of his presidency.
Yeah, both terms.
But Representative Weldon of Florida opposed the House bill to expand embryonic stem cell research. And he used, it's worthy of note because he used basically absolute pseudoscience to support his position. Again, this goes beyond the scope of political value judgments. He's a physician, first of all, mm-hmm. and he was using his position as a physician to bolster his points, which were scientific. And here's what they were. He basically says that we don't need embryonic stem cell research because we can achieve the same ends through adult stem cell research. This no scientist, of course, believes this. This is the scientific community maintains almost unanimously that embryonic stem cells have much greater potential than adult-derived stem cells because an embryonic stem cell still has all of its potential to become any other kind of cell in the body that goes to make up a person. Mm-hmm. Whereas an adult-derived stem cell is already differentiated to some degree. It's already limited in the kinds of cells that it could turn into.
It's not as flexible.
It's not as potent.
That seems like common sense.
They might have some utility.
The adult stem cells, you know, can potentially have tremendous utility. It's not to say that they're not worthwhile, and there's a lot of very good research using adult stem cells. But it's a fallacy to argue that they are a complete replacement for embryonic stem cells,
right,
so that they make embryonic stem cell research redundant or unnecessary,
right.
And that was his position. So he completely misrepresented the difference between adult and embryonic stem cells. He also, even more egregious, he used as an example of the power of adult-derived stem cells an anecdotal story of a young girl who was paralyzed because of a spinal cord injury, who went to a clinic in Portugal,
mm-hmm.
where she had adult-derived stem cells injected into her spinal cord, and he claims that she was greatly helped by this treatment. Not that she was totally cured, but that she had much improved strength and motor function. Now, you know, for those listeners who don't know, I am a practicing academic neurologist. I happen to know about these clinics because I've investigated them and their claims and their treatments, because the, you know, for the treatment of neurological diseases, and I've had many patients ask me about them. These clinics are total frauds. These are quack clinics. What they're doing has no scientific legitimacy whatsoever. They're using techniques which may one day prove valuable, but they are at the level where we should be, you know, investigating their basic technology of using them in animals. They're just injecting some cocktail of adult-derived stem cells, specifically derived from olfactory tissue, which is the tissue you can get from the nasal cavity. And they're not really saying what's in the cocktail, and they haven't done any research to show that what they're doing actually works. We only hear, you know, we all know the fallacy of anecdotal evidence. We only hear from the patients who think they were helped. You know,
they're not being transparent.
They're not being transparent. The patients who die over there, you know, we never hear about them. Or the patients who were not helped. They're not accounting for what we call the cheerleader effect. You know, you do anything to somebody who is weak or can't function very well.
These all sound like some pretty big red flags.
Yeah, right. These clinics are basically trying to just get tens of thousands of dollars from rich European and American desperate patients. There's a lot of them in China and in other parts of the world where there isn't, you know, close regulation of this. It's now a cottage industry in these countries. But this representative, a physician, was using this, you know, unvalidated anecdote from this, you know, questionable offshore clinic to bolster his scientific claims. I was totally appalled that he did this. It really was reprehensible.
You think that it was because he was an incompetent scientist, or do you think he simply let his emotions and political will override him?
I don't think we can disentangle those two things. I think it's probably a little of both. It's hard to say. He misrepresented the difference between adult and embryonic stem cells. There's also different ways in which stem cells can be used. All of the research that's being done with the olfactory-derived stem cells are used. The stem cells are being used as support cells. In other words, you inject them into a damaged spinal cord, and they don't replace the damaged spinal cord tissue. They take up shop as support cells that help the nerve cells heal or function better, or maybe survive longer. Mm-hmm. So it's a completely different approach than, say, what you would use an embryonic stem cell for, which
grow new
potentially
nerve
could
tissue.
Be to, yeah, actually replace damaged or dead nervous tissue. So either he didn't understand that distinction, or he didn't care. And you know, there's no way for us to know. I don't even know what kind of physician he is, but he's not practicing now. I don't think he was ever an academic or a scientist. But you know, again, if you're going to fight this issue on political grounds, then do it. You know, do it on moral, ethical, political grounds. But if you're going to make a scientific argument, you know, then the public is best served if good science is being represented, you know, in the Congress and in the Senate. And this was not good science.
Right.
Steve, did you I read an article recently. I think it was Discover Magazine. This doctor was looking for other methods, some way to get around the ethical quagmire that stem cell research is in, and he came up with an intriguing idea. I'm curious as to your take on it. He was saying that instead of using stem cells, I mean, there are certain conditions that in which the human body can produce a tumor-like object that actually it's not a conventional tumor. It's actually human tissue, fully developed human tissue, in this bizarre kind of horrific mass that could include things like a tooth and other like disparate pieces of your body in this tumor. And his idea is that we can potentially use this idea to grow parts of human bodies and kind of sidestep the whole ethical quandary that we're in with stem cells.
Yeah, I mean, those kind of tumors are called teratomas.
Okay,
and
yes.
They, they can't potentially grow any kind of tissue in them, so they're usually a mass of hair and bone and teeth and liver
right.
and whatever else.
Does that sound like a plausible yeah. thing that maybe we should be looking into? Or is
yeah, it's certainly interesting. Certainly something is happening in these tumors, which is causing adult cells to differentiate into lots of different kinds of tissue, although we don't know if they could turn into any kind of cell that we might need, what the real potential of this is. That is what I would characterize as an interesting avenue of further research, but you can't. It's way too preliminary to draw any
right.
conclusions about it. And that's the whole. That's the final point about all of this is, you know, a lot of people who oppose stem cell research saying, well, you know, embryonic stem cells haven't cured anybody yet, and we don't know if they are going to produce any cures. Well, yeah, of course we don't know. This is all. We're all talking about research, and you just have no way of knowing where basic science research is going to lead. The
right.
idea is that scientists, the public is best served if scientists are allowed to follow where their interest takes them, where the leads take them. They think that this would be a very, very lucrative area of research, and we just won't know what will happen until they try it. You know, this research can crash and burn and could run into obstacles that they didn't anticipate. For example, we may never figure out how to use these stem cells without causing these horrific tumors to occur. I mean, that's a serious problem. You know, developing the technology to get the cells to do what you want them to do, but not just become these big, you know, horrific tumors. And we can't assume that we're going to solve these problems, you know, or how long it will take us to solve them. But we will never know unless we do the research. That's the
right.
whole point.
That's essential.
Well, I'm gonna change topics here a little bit because it's the beginning of June. It's almost the end of school for America's youths.
Summer solstice is coming.
The summer solstice is almost upon us, and you know what season this is, what the end of school brings to the English-speaking part of the world.
Bikini parties.
True. Crop circles.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yes, right.
Yeah,
almost forgot about those.
It's just my subscription to Seriology Monthly ran out.
Seriology.
Seriology.
Yes, it just wouldn't be summer without crop circles.
Without crop circles, yeah. So,
you know, in California they have what's known as sand circles. It's crop circles
true?
In the sand.
I knew it.
But yeah, but who would draw pictures in the sand? I mean, just
aliens.
Go away. So, to give the basic background, you know, for the last 20 years or so, increasingly intricate designs have been appearing in fields of wheat and barley and corn, first in England for a number of years and then spreading to other countries. The believers feel that these pictograms are an attempt at communication from either extraterrestrials or extra-dimensional beings, maybe our distant future selves.
Right.
And they've actually, you know, tried to build this into a serious study. You know, they actually call it seriology. Of course, you throw ology at the end of anything, you can make it sound like it's an actual science.
I always thought the itity fit it better. Stupidity. I saw a picture not that long ago of a field with this very complicated and a design in it, and the fella said he thought it was ancient Sanskrit. And the guy who was writing the article said, I just didn't understand why the aliens were trying to communicate to us with ancient Sanskrit. What's wrong with English? Or even French.
Or numbers, or anything.
Why ancient Sanskrit?
Yeah, something intelligible would be nice. Well, certainly, if it is an attempt at communication, I think we could characterize this attempt as an unmitigated failure.
Agreed.
It's so stupid. Aliens are flattening down our wheat. It's just so dumb. Anyway, sorry. It's just,
this guy, Chris Hardiman, thinks that these pictures are technical schematics. There's
okay. I'd like
one
to see what
crop
he's
circle called the Barbary Castle crop circle, and it looks, it's roughly a triangle, but you could interpret the drawing as a tetrahedron, you know, a pyramid shape, if you interpret it as a three-dimensional structure. So he built a tetrahedron with the little shapes on the end, the circle and whatever, you know, to make it look as much like the crop circle as possible. He actually claims that if you apply an electrical current to this device that he built, which is huge, it's, you know, like 6 feet, 7 feet tall, that it levitates. And he's been able to reproducibly levitate the device many times.
How about that?
And I assume he's asking people to invest a little money in his corporation, and then he'll give them a demonstration. And any day now, they'll be reaping the rewards of.
I wonder why the scientific community has been totally silent about this.
Yeah. Well, where's the Nobel Prize for this gentleman? I mean, forget the investors. He could be.
Yeah, right.
Independently wealthy without them.
Where's our fleet of anti-gravity ships? I mean, come on.
I haven't even seen this on a current affair, so, I mean, the guy's really low down on the feeding.
I think even the Weekly World News missed that one.
Yeah. Off the charts. Well, I mean, you know, this is, what's in their stupid study, Stephen? Something about the circles are too perfect.
Well, they
could possibly be created by man.
They have a lot of hand-waving explanations. I mean, it's a good example to me of how a belief system can arise out of anything. There's really nothing so silly that people will not build it up into some big mystery. So this follows the typical pattern of mystery mongering, which is you search for something which appears to be an anomaly, and then you argue that this anomalous feature means that this has to have a supernatural or paranormal explanation. So it's a logical fallacy that because something cannot currently be explained, it's unexplainable. Sometimes it's the argument from personal incredulity, which is just that they can't explain it. The perfect circle thing, I don't know if you guys remember, a number of years ago we were at the psychic was doing a reading at a local bookstore. We decided to infiltrate to harass them. And the topic of crop circles came up. And one woman made that very point. Yeah, but the circles are perfect. That's unexplainable. Well, yeah, until you invent this really archaic device. It's called a string and a peg. Come on. Didn't these people ever use a compass in, like, grade school?
They apparently didn't go to grade school, Steve.
I used to use them in my circle.
The uneducated masses of society trying to...
I mean, a perfect circle to the graininess of, like, stalks of wheat or corn.
Right.
You could easily do with a plank, a stake, and a piece of rope. But that was an anomaly to them that was unexplainable.
Yeah, you know, that's something they read on the website, that's what they say now. But it's a perfect circle.
Seem to care that, you know, human beings readily repeat this experiment exactly the same way the whomever else is doing these circles. They have no comment for that, right?
Well, don't confuse them with the facts. They have these other what they call biophysical markers or something that things that, you know, if you look at the wheat stalks, they're bent over in a strange way, or the stalks are you know, have some crystals on them or something. But they don't know what this means. Again, this is just an apparent anomaly. There's no gold standard of what an alien-created crop circle is, for example. And, in fact, these features are seen in all circles, even ones that were made that we know were made by people, where it's documented that they were man-made.
Yeah, I mean, the kids go out at night, they videotape the whole thing, and then they wait for it to be discovered, and people start saying things like, you know, this is a bona fide, genuine crop circle. I mean, all the anomalies are there. The unexplainable perfect circles are there, and then, you know, then they show the video of the kids doing it, and surprisingly, I mean, well, actually not surprisingly, because it fits human psychology perfectly, the people will still believe it, even in the face of evidence. I mean,
they think the video is a hoax.
Right. Yeah, right.
Or they'll say, "Oh, I guess the Men in Black got to them."
Right. The ultimate computer graphics now.
The ultimate fallback of true believers is the conspiracy theory, because it's unfalsifiable. It explains away all inconvenient evidence. It accounts for the lack of evidence for whatever they want to believe. The conspiracy theory solves all problems, which is why it's worthless. Because you could use it to explain anything that explains everything. In fact, explains nothing.
Well, conspiracy theories are just theories. I mean, you can't put much weight behind a theory.
That's right. Evolutionary theory, conspiracy theory. Right.
My favorite one was in Connecticut about a year ago. It was last summer. There was a local woman, Martha Bailey, has a cornfield in New Milford, and overnight a quote unquote perfect square appeared in her field. And she was convinced that this was something paranormal, and this is a quote from her. You know, her cornfield is surrounded by a gate, a chicken wire fence.
Oh, wow.
And she says, well, everything was secure, the gates were locked, it had to be something that touched down and flattened it.
Well, yeah, we all know that a chicken wire fence is, you know, is as impenetrable as a force field.
Unbreachable.
I mean, what can get through that? Come on.
Well, I'd show you if the desire to believe comes first, and then the logic comes second.
Absolutely.
Well, or not at all.
Now, of course, the crop circle situation is all the more interesting because the two British gentlemen,
Doug and Bob,
they started Doug and the
Dave,
whole thing.
Yeah, Doug and Dave,
who started the whole thing.
Right.
And they, that's Doug Bauer and David Chorley. Those are the gentlemen. They basically, over a couple of pints at the pub in the early 80s, decided that they would start doing this as just as a joke. And then it got totally out of hand. It basically took on a life of its own. They ended up doing it for like 20 years. And then in 1991, they admitted to the world that they started the whole thing. They were the first ones to do it. They came up with the idea. They'd been doing it for decades. And they demonstrated their techniques, which they were able to make
perfect circles.
Yes, perfect circles. Designs as complex as any that had been seen up to that point. But and you read the websites or you read the writings of the seriologists and the mental gyrations they go through to dismiss Doug and Dave's admissions. One was just comical. The author was stating that these guys were somehow like too good and they must be shills for the government and they were part of some conspiracy. They were too articulate.
Too articulate.
Just silly comments. But
how cool is that? Can you imagine you and your buddy starting a paranormal phenomenon yourselves?
Right.
That takes off and turns into a worldwide phenomenon? I would just be laughing all day. I mean,
and they were. They thought it was a hoot. I mean, they just
can you imagine
so
how
fun.
Cool? That's what I want to do before I die. I want to start a paranormal.
You want to be
phenomenon.
The next L. Ron Hubbard? Is
that's
that
all
what you're
me.
Saying?
You know what, guys? Here's the thing. Right now, the four of us can invent a ridiculous paranormal phenomenon from whole cloth, document its creation on this podcast, and it wouldn't matter. People would still believe it.
Yeah.
And there's no amount of evidence that would be able to convince them that we invented this ourselves. Even listening to this podcast, because they would think that this was faked.
Of course. It was fake, scripted, all part of the conspiracy.
Yeah, I mean, you reach a point
absolutely.
Where you've got such an emotional investment and, so much pride that your mind won't let you give in and say, all right, I'm wrong. I mean, so few people will go that far and actually say
it's
that.
Hard, it's hard to have the intellectual courage to admit that you were wrong in a huge way.
But it's almost
it takes
not existent. It's almost not existent. I mean, I can't remember the last time I said to myself, wow, that guy is just so cool for admitting it.
Stephen Hawking did it.
Yeah.
Oh, but what, about a black hole?
Yeah, he about...
His bet with...
the bet with the other physicist. About some aspect of black holes. But, yeah, good scientists will do it, but, not if they have their whole career dedicated to it. It's be kind of hard to say, yeah, but the last 30 years of research I did was all worthless because it was based upon a false assumption.
Right. That would be tough. But that's why it's good that you've got the old scientists dying and the new scientists coming on up because they they don't have that emotional investment. So there
right.
is
or just that it's a competitive community effort. You know, there's other scientists who'll tell you that you're an idiot, even if you won't admit it.
Right.
And then you just get marginalized. That's what,
right.
that's what I see happen all the time. If you really cling to some wrong idea because it's your idea, it's your pet, you get marginalized. People stop inviting you to review papers and to meetings and to consensus committees because you're
good.
An idiot.
It's a good way to read them.
Well, they should.
As well they should. That's right. I've seen that happen. You know, and so it basically scientists, because it's such a community effort, they're forced to do that and to not really invest themselves emotionally too much in any one idea. And because they're used to the confrontational, sort of critical nature of science, where, you know, the whole point of peer review is for your ideas to be harshly criticized and by others, you know, obviously in a constructive way, not in a personal way, but they're going to make every attempt to prove you wrong, and only if your ideas survive that attempt do they have any value, or are they given any respect for maybe you're onto something.
Right.
And pseudoscientists don't get that, like the crop circle guys. You know, you ask penetrating, probing scientific questions and about the crop circles and about their claims and about their explanations, and they think that you're attacking them personally. It's like, you know, if you want to play the game of science, you need to learn
right.
the rules, you know?
Right. And they don't. They don't care.
No, the love of the love of the fantastic is it gets them through the day, and they don't. Doing science is not part of the equation.
No.
Too much hard work.
It is. Science
hard
is hard work.
Hard
work. Thinking and being rigorous and paying attention to detail, and it's all very, very hard work. It's so much easier just to believe what you want to believe.
All overrated, all that.
That's sort of a running theme throughout all these topics we've been touching on tonight and on other nights.
Well, that is the common underlying themes of what we call scientific skepticism, which is basically just applying logic, evidence, and reason to any claims. And just it's really just common sense applied in a rigorous fashion. That's really all it is. There's nothing magical
right.
or special about it. It's just, you know, accounting for all the evidence, making sure your logic is valid, you know, being open-minded and unbiased, controlling for factors like confirmation bias and things
mm-hmm.
that will
right. I mean,
the mechanisms that we use to deceive ourselves.
Right. A lot of it's overcoming human psychology.
Right.
You know, it's such an insidious thing. It tries to, you know, make things happen the way we want them to happen, and it makes us believe it wholeheartedly. You know, you convince yourself, but science is a great tool for doing away with that, and it needs to be done. Otherwise, you can convince yourself of anything.
You can
absolutely.
The brain is a flawed organ; it can convince itself with religious fervor of anything. There's nothing so silly or ridiculous or miraculous that people will not believe it to their death.
Exactly.
That's why we need science. Science is really just a way of enabling us to see what's real and what's not real in some valid way.
And that's why we can't afford to have our science watered down with things like creationism.
Right. Which
yes.
which brings us full circle and is a good note to end this week's podcast. Brings us full crop circle.
A perfect circle.
So thank you again for joining us on The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Until next week, this is Steve Novella.